Well, I don't really have a slideshow tonight like I do for a lot of things, but it was about 5:30 this evening, and I thought, 5:38, I think, actually, and I thought, there are pictures of some of these things. They're going to be online. You should just get them and bung them in something and then show them. So we'll have a few pictures, but it's not like everything. I did get inspired. If I do this again, I'll try to do more, get more going. So I'll start off with a little bit about the context into which Ramakrishna came and a little bit about his very early life. If you happen to be at this class a year ago, we did a lot more with the early life then. And then we'll go on to when he went to the big temple and kind of his entry and some interesting things that happened there. But then the main part of what we'll talk about tonight is his practice of finding God through different religions and different sects. And that'll be the main part of it. And if I ever do it again, maybe we'll go to the last part of his life when his disciples and all came. He was born in West Bengal. Let's see if I'm all set up to do this. Oh, first I wanted to tell you, there are three actual pictures of him. Just three pictures. This is one. He was at one of his disciples' houses, and he's in Samadhi. And the man who is actually holding him up, his name is Sridhai. He's Ramakrishna's nephew, and he worked very closely with him and supported him and took care of him, did some of his duties for him, and so on through much of his early life. So that's one real picture of him. You know, a lot of these saints, when you get back there, Anselm, Anthony, you know, we have no pictures. And so it's kind of nice to have pictures. This was a formal one that was taken in a studio. And one of his devotees must have set it up and gotten it. In fact, this one was taken apparently only because this photographer was coming to take pictures of his disciples' family. And so they pulled it all together and ended up taking a picture of him too. And I haven't been able to read to see if he did it like Master did sometimes. So it was like, oh, they're going to take a picture? Let me go into Samadhi. Of course, it was an uncommon thing to take pictures in the mid-19th century. So, and then that probably the best known picture of him. And I don't know what the circumstances were of this. It's interesting, his mouth is kind of open often. Well, we have these three pictures, it is of them. But people talk, I read repeatedly, people who knew him or saw him talking about how sweet his smile was. And that's not exactly how that looks to me, you know. So there must be something missed in getting out onto the photograph from real life. But he had a very, very sweet smile. Okay, so he was born in Bengal. It's the same general area that Master was born in. It's about 60 miles northwest of Calcutta. And to kind of get a feel for when it was, he was a contemporary of Lahiri Mahashaya. So as far as we know, they never actually met. But they lived at about the same time period. Sri Yukteswar, one of Lahiri's main disciples, we might say main, and Vivekananda, who was Ramakrishna's successor, were actually friends. So they knew each other. Sri Yukteswar was in his late 20s when Ramakrishna died. But people born about the same time that we might know about were Andrew Carnegie, Pope Pius X, the artist Winslow Homer, Bret Hart, the name that you probably associate with more current things, Milton Bradley, the guy who designed all the games and the big game company he was born in. And some people who died about the same time that Ramakrishna did. Ulysses S. Grant, Franz Liszt, the composer, John Deere, the tractor maker. So just to kind of try to put it in perspective, in this country, the West was still all territories, not states yet. I think the 25th state had just come in to the Union when he was born. Texas was still an independent country. So it was back there a little ways, you know, to try to put it in perspective. Well, he was born into a very poor but very pious Brahmin family. And Rama was the family deity, and he was worshipped without fail multiple times a day, at least if you count the offering of the food and all. And his mother spent quite a bit of time in worship. But that whole area, and this is his neighborhood, we think that he lived right across the paddy or the pond, whatever that is, from that little temple. But it was rural, it was pastoral. When he was growing up there, it was a great life for a kid. And the name of it is Kamarpukur village. Well, as is often true with saints of high stature, there were announcements and things went on before the birth. Both parents had several experiences, but I'll just tell about a couple of very notable ones. In the spring of the year before Ramakrishna was born, the next February, his father had to go off on a trip to take care of some kind of family business, or it was actually an ancestral rite that he had to go do. So he went pretty far away to Gaya, you know, close to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened. So he was off there taking care of this this ancestral obligation. And as he was sleeping, a vision came to him and awakened him. And there was a huge, luminous being that was gazing at him, but gazing at him very affectionately. And probably really good he was gazing at him affectionately, because the being was Lord Vishnu in the form where he has the huge mace. Right, the mace, you know, the big club, and that club is called Gada, and his name is Gadahar. And so you often see him with the mace, but in certain, what do you call it? Well, certainly certain pictures of it, certain representations of him, certain modes that Vishnu is in, the club, the mace, is really huge. And in Lord Gadahara, of course, it is. But in a very sweet voice, he called his father by name and said, Kudiram, Ramakrishna's father, Kudiram, your great devotion to me has made me very happy. The time has come for me to return to earth, to incarnate, and I shall be born as your son. Just boom, boom, boom. So I don't know if you knew that, but Ramakrishna is considered to be an incarnation of Vishnu. Well, he was filled with joy initially and was elated. And then he thought, oh no, one more mouth to feed. How am I going to do that? And so he said, no, Lord, I'm not fit. I can't accept this honor because I'm too poor to serve you properly. But Lord Gadahara said, do not be afraid, Kudiram. Whatever you feed me, I will enjoy. And so he then, the vision ended, and he was convinced that the Lord of the universe was going to come into his own home. Well, when he got home, a few days at least later, because of the distance, he went in to greet his wife, and his wife looked really different. She was actually glowing, he thought, and clearly looked very uplifted. And so she immediately began to tell the story of what happened to her while he was away. I was visiting the Yogi Shiva temple, which is that little temple right there, right across the street, or across the paddy from where they lived. I was visiting the Yogi Shiva temple, and I saw that the holy image of Shiva was inside. There, he's two door closers. And you can see it's small. There's probably only room for five or six people or something in there. The little things are all over little neighborhood temples in India. But I saw that the holy image that was there of Shiva in that temple was alive. It began to send forth waves of the most beautiful light, slowly at first and then quicker and quicker until they filled up the inside of the temple, and then they burst pouring out of the temple like a huge flood when the river, the waves that come from the river in a huge river flood. And one of them was coming right toward me, one of the waves of light. I was going to run and tell Donnie, a neighbor woman, but then the waves washed over me and swallowed me up, and I could feel that wave of light enter my body. I fell to the ground unconscious, and then Donnie went and found her later, the next morning. Apparently she stayed out there unconscious all night. And then she told her husband, ever since then, I have been filled with joy, and my health, which had been a problem, has been better than ever. Only one thing, I can still feel the light inside me, and I think I am a child. So Kudiram then shared his story with her, and together the pious, although very poor, couple awaited the birth of their child. So his name was Gadahar. That was his given name. They called him the first three syllables of the Lord's name. And what that means, that word, what it represents, is spiritual, mental, and physical strength and power. And certainly by the end of his life, he had exhibited much of that. But it also has another meaning, a more subtle meaning, and the idea was that when you went out into battle with that mace, or when Vishnu did, that it also had the effect of intoxicating the enemy and making them less able to attack or whatever. And much of Ramakrishna's life, he was intoxicated, but with the experience of God. And so, I don't know if there's a connection, but I thought that was fun when I learned about that. Well, his childhood was similar to many young boys. He was playful, lively, filled with fun, and they had this wonderful place to grow up in. The only thing was that even when he was fairly young, probably 4 or 5, certainly by 6, when he would hear the story of a saint, he would somehow go unconscious. I mean, that's what the people observed that were around him. And it was like his mind would shift at least, and he would be somewhere else. But sometimes he would actually go unconscious. So this happened even when he was very young. He went to the village school with some regularity, but he was not very interested at all. He learned how to read and write in Bengali, so he was not illiterate. You know, and that's master's native language too, is Bengali. And master also didn't care for school very much. As you recall. So he did go to school for several years and then dropped out. He had 4 siblings, but only one, his older brother, really played a part in his life. Well, his father died when Ramakrishna was 7, and it was a great loss to him because they'd been very close. But once his father passed away, he became closer and closer to his mother over time until they had a very good connection. And he also became much more meditative and much more inward beginning at the age of 7. One of the things he did after his father passed away was he started going out and haunting the crematoriums, cremation grounds, to meditate. And to, I don't know what was in his mind, I can't tell you, but you know, it's the whole thing of yogis going to cemeteries and all to try to release their attachment to this lifetime. So when he was 9, according to custom, he was invested with the Brahmanical thread, which allowed him to perform ritualistic worship in the Brahmin household. And so immediately he started assisting his mother in doing the worship, and just in a very short time, she had put him in charge of it, and he was doing almost all of the family worship there. He learned,
Jane. There's that little temple up closer.
So that would have been very important to the family. He no doubt spent a lot of time there too, it just being so close
by his home. And that's what it looks like now. Mm-hmm.
So it's become a kind of shrine, of course. So you could go there. They're going to India. I think they're here tonight to see what they should, some of the things they should go see when they're in India. It's, probably an hour outside of Calcutta. So he had an interesting situation because of the location of the village. It was a transit point on a very well-established pilgrimage route. So almost all of north and eastern Bengal, if they were going to go to Puri on pilgrimage, they had to come through that village. And Puri is where the famed Jagannath temple was. Shankaracharya, Adi Shankaracharya in the 8th century, maybe. I see a nodding head. Good. Yes, two nodding heads. Must be right then. In the 8th century, established four temples, a kind of like the cardinal points of India. And the tradition is, if you want to be a really good Hindu and whatever, once you pass on, then you need to visit those, all four of those shrines, those temples, and they are not close together. Like I said, they're kind of at the extremes, north, south, east, west in India. And this is the one that's on the far east. So thousands and thousands of people would flock there to do their obeisance. And just while we're looking at that, I'll show you what the main gods look like. Every time I see them, I think, they look like cartoon figures. But it's, you know, it's not doing the representational thing. It's part of making you recalibrate your thoughts of God. At any rate, people would flood to his village, and so he would go out and hang out with them when they stayed overnight there. And many, many monks would come on their way to pilgrimage. And there was a major rest house in the little village where the monks would stay. So he would go and stay with the monks. And there was a group of people, I forget, but anyway, from ancient times in India, they would sing the Puranas. And they'd memorize the Puranas and they would sing them. That's one way they were passed down. And so many, many of those came. And so he learned the scriptures by ear from these people talking about it and from them being repeated. Kataks. That's what they're called. Not that anybody cares. His first ecstatic experience was when he was out one day walking along the narrow ridges that are created in the paddy fields, between the paddy fields. And as he was walking, he's nine. And as he's walking along, the sky starts to darken. And pretty soon there's one huge, huge black cloud, really black cloud. And that black cloud spreads across the skyscape. And it's very unusual. So he's watching it, filled with rain, no doubt, but very black. And then here come a whole flock of white cranes flying right across the jet black cloud. And he went into an ecstatic experience. It was his first real time of being out of the body. And he says this about it. Later in life, he told his disciples this: they were as white as milk against that black cloud. It was so beautiful that I became completely absorbed in the sight. Then I lost consciousness of everything outward. And so he collapsed, and they found him the next morning, again, out there. So by the time he was 10 or 11, he was having a lot of these kind of ecstatic experiences. Well, the family fell on hard times within a few years after the father passed away. And the brother knew he had to do something about it. So he went off to Calcutta and started a Sanskrit school. And to make extra money on the side, he started a pujari business. He would go to homes or to different events and sing, you know, all the right chants, recite the scriptures, perform the ceremonies and the rituals as they were supposed to be for whatever the event was. And soon that business was really booming. He clearly was good at it. And the school was doing okay, but he had way too much to do in the Pujari business. And so he sent home for Ramakrishna and asked Ramakrishna to come and help him out with that. And so he came. He was about 16 when he showed up in Calcutta to help his brother. And his brother really tried to get him to go back to school and study. But he didn't have as much authority over him as Sri Yukteswar did over Master. So Ramakrishna declined and didn't go. But about a year after Ramakrishna showed up, his brother was invited, as by this time, surely, a well-known pujari for this to happen. He was invited by the woman who built the temple at Dakshineswar to come and be the officiating priest there. And so he did. And as you can see, it's quite something. And his Ramakrishna's brother is the one that did all the dedication and all the ceremonial opening of it. And Ramakrishna was there too. And that's when he first met this woman, Rani. And we talked about a lot about this last year. I won't this time, but she was his Rajasi, Janakananda. She was very, very wealthy. And she built this temple, and soon she got into it, you know, had a very good connection with Ramakrishna and supported what he wanted to do. She died away died just a few years, and her son-in-law took over the family estate and finances and all, and he continued and became very, very close to Ramakrishna. So he was bankrolled, which seems to be important in this when we're on the material plane. Well, soon, the brother was invited then to come and be the main priest at the temple and run things. And within a year or so, Ramakrishna also left the pujari business and joined him at the temple. And he was put in charge of one of these little Krishna temples. There are, I think, 12. There are 12. Does anybody know? I think there are 12 Krishna temples all along the side of this complex. It's a part of the Dakshineswar place, and it's great to go in and see all the different altars and everything. But he was put in charge of one of those, and so given the position, and so he conducted the worship and all in that. And then just about a year later, but he was also given the job of dressing Kali in the temple, of dressing the main deity. And there she is. It's so different. Kali especially is so different than most of our Western expectations of a deity. So he was given the responsibility of taking care, you know, the bathing, the dressing, and all of Kali. So this is really the beginning of his relationship with this particular form, this particular symbol of Kali. So his brother passed away after about a year of him having gone to the temple, and then Ramakrishna was appointed head priest of the temple. So he began there also to have these ecstatic experiences. And he tells about one, which is very interesting. There was an unbearable pain in my heart because I could not see the mother in real life. Could see the statue. Just as a man wrings a towel with all his strength to get the water out of it, so I felt as if my heart and mind were being wrung out. I began to think I would never see the mother. I was dying of despair. In my agony, I said to myself, what is the use of living this life? And immediately my eyes fell upon the ceremonial sword that hangs in the temple. I decided to end my life with it, then and there. Like a madman, I ran to it and seized it. And then I had the most marvelous vision of Mother. And I fell down unconscious. Then he says that he was able to came back to some semblance of sensibility, and It was as if houses, doors, the temple, everything had vanished altogether. It was as if there was nothing anywhere. But what I saw was an infinite, shoreless sea of light, a sea that was conscious. However far in whatever direction I looked, I saw shining waves, one after another, coming toward me. They were raging and storming upon me with great speed, and soon they were on me. I panted and struggled and again lost consciousness. So after this first vision of Kali there, he basically couldn't keep it together in front of her anymore. He would always go into an ecstatic experience. And so the man who was holding him up in one of those first pictures, Sri Dai, his nephew, came there full time to help him. And he was still the head priest, but he couldn't function very well in the duties in the temple. So Sri Dai did those for him. And when he would go in, another thing that would happen as well as going into ecstasy would be that his body would lock up, joint by joint, from the lower extremities up. And it made a clacking sound, like the bones were hitting together or something. He doesn't say they were. But it made like a clattering sound. And he would not be able to move until Divine Mother would release him. And then the bones, one by one, would unlock all the way down. But it wasn't at all within his conscious control. Aren't you glad we have Master? I mean, I find this really interesting. And I love to hear about it. And it stretches my mind. I don't know about my joints locking up as I'm going forward on this path. You know? Anyway. Here's another really fun thing. When he's talking about one of the times he went into ecstasy. And he says, in the beginning of this particular ecstatic vision, I saw particles of light, like a huge group of fireflies. I saw all quarters covered with masses of mist-like points of light. And then I perceived that all things were pervaded by bright waves of light. I saw these things sometimes with my eyes shut, and then I would open them, and I would still see them with my eyes open. I did not understand what I saw, nor did I know whether it was good or bad to have such visions. But does that ring a bell with anyone? I think it's light as particles and light as waves, which our sciences didn't even understand until the mid-20th century. But he was experiencing the truth of how light functioned in his ecstatic condition. Well, he went back to the village when he was about 23 years old because rumors, of course, had gotten back to his family about how crazy he was acting there. And they got very, very worried about him because he seemed mentally unstable. And you have to realize, we're talking about this and listening to this knowing he was an avatar. They didn't have a clue. All they knew was that there was this borderline schizoid running around and had been given all this power in the temple, and whatever they tried to do about it, the people in charge of the temple kept him there. And of course the parents were very worried because they would hear all, not the parents, but the mother, because she would hear these tales. So who was it? Must have been, at this point, his oldest brother, whoever that was. Not his elder brother, because he was gone. But the family decided that if he would get married, maybe that would help stabilize him and settle him down. He would have additional responsibility. This should be a big help. So they sent word to him to come home. It was time for him to get married. He had to get married. So he sent word back and said, okay, let me tell you where to find my bride. And described the place, family, and the girl. And then he went back to the village. And they went and they found her and they brought her He was 5 at the time. 5 years old. And he is 23. And so they got married there. And then as it wasn't that unusual, you know, in that time in India for that. But then the bride would go back and live with her family for a number of years. And often then would come, you know, when, you know, age of 10 or a young teenager, would come back and live in the house of the husband's family. But still, you know, they wouldn't have consummated the marriage. So the impact that it had on him was very minimal, because he just went back to the temple once he got married. She went back to her home, and everything was the same, but he kept his family as happy as he was willing to. So by the time his wife, his bride, joined him a decade later, Ramakrishna had already become a monastic. So that marriage was never consummated. But just to jump ahead a little bit, when that happened, Ramakrishna took the role of the priest in performing the ritual ceremony that installed his wife, Sharda Devi is her name, installed her as divine mother in person. She became the additional symbol of divine mother in the temple, and at certain festivals and certain times would go and sit on the throne of divine mother. And she lived 30-some years beyond him and had a very active role in the spread of his teachings and the founding of the Ramakrishna Math, and had her own legions of disciples as well. Two or three great books, I didn't bring them and I can't tell you the names, but there are two or three great books about her life and her own depth. One of them, at least, all quotations from her. Well, he goes back to Dakshineswar. His 5-year-old bride is off at her house. And it all starts up again. All the spiritual tempests begin. And he had about 2 years. He embarks here on a 12-year period of ecstatic experiences and intense sadhana. And the first 2 years is mostly just intense ecstatic worship. He had long stretches of times that he couldn't close his eyes. He would try to get the eyelids to go down with his fingers, but they wouldn't move. He couldn't get them to close. And in that 12 years, there's some 6-year period there where he says he didn't sleep at all. He didn't sleep for 6 years. But he would leave the temple and go out to do something, and they couldn't find him. And I mean, he didn't come back, and they would go out to find him, and they'd find him there sitting on the pavement, the roadside with no clothes on. And many times he gave them to beggars, to people that he felt apparently were more needy than he. He would go down the street in his state of ecstasy and be convinced that women were Sita or Radha or someone, and go and worship them. And this apparently especially made waves when he was in the prostitute section of Calcutta, and he would be going and bowing and touching the feet of the street women that were walking. Young kids, boys, he would often think were Krishna. So, of course, he would do the same thing. And he was very generous. They found him more than once sitting, sharing his meal with a dog. Or maybe he did with cats, too. I'm not sure. But that's it. And then sometimes they just found him laid out in ecstasy. And one notable time, snakes were crawling across his body, and often, you know, flies were going in and out of things. But he was in bliss. Anyway, he had about 2 years where he was exhibiting that kind of behavior, and it was really a great challenge for a lot of the local worshipers in the temple, because he's the head priest again, right? And doing all this crazy stuff. And many of them just felt they didn't come up to their standards, you know, of behavior in a religious place. And I wondered why on earth the powers that be would let Ramakrishna get away with such inappropriate behavior. And from time to time they would come together and go and ask that he be banned from the temple. But both his benefactress in the beginning and then her son-in-law later knew what he was, and wouldn't listen to them, just felt they all had to put up with it for the blessings that were pouring through him that so many of the people didn't get. So just before we launch into the practice of the religions, I don't know if you have this question, but I certainly have been looking at it. It's like, you know, why all the trauma? Why all the drama? You know, this person obviously completely dedicated to finding God. Why is all this going on? And, you know, in the stuff that I've read, I haven't really heard that, haven't seen that addressed a lot. But the thought that comes to me is that all he had was worship. You know, here's this avatar coming into a situation where all he could do, all that he was trained to do, all people knew how to tell him what to do, was just worship. But no practices to prepare him for both the physical, you know, the physiological and the astral and the psychological thing that had to happen for him to find God. So he, you know, didn't have the practices, pranayamas or kriya or kundalini working experiences. And so all the way up until this time, when he's, what, 25 now, 1861, he really hadn't been guided. He was just floundering around on his own. So I don't know. That's just my opinion, that it seems like that's what it is. But then he began to get training. He began to have these people come to him. And he says later on, it was really miraculous. He would begin to think about Islam or Christianity or Tantra or something, and pretty soon someone would come right up to the temple who was an expert in that area, and he would get to meet them, see them, and they would talk, and before long he was doing those practices. So do you want to take a little break right now? Or do you want to go ahead, or do you want me to do the first practice and then take a break, see if we want a break?
The first practice.
Okay, let's do that, then we'll check. So the first thing that he learned how to do, the first set of practices, were tantric practices. Ramakrishna was collecting flowers out in a garden in the temple area, and he saw this boat coming down with this very stately, large, tall, orange-robed, middle-aged woman who he could probably tell if she was an ascetic, and was. And so he runs back toward the temple and tells Sridai, there's someone who's going to come right away. There's a woman who's going to come into the temple grounds, and I want you to tell her to come and see me in my rooms. Sridai's going, what? You want me to tell her to come to your room? And he said, yes, tell her as soon as she gets here. And he says, well, I can't do that. I mean, no woman goes into your rooms anyway. And this woman, we don't even know her. She's not even here yet. And you want me to send her there? He said, just tell her that I invited her, and that'll be enough. So good old faithful Sridai, once the kind of, I picture as a kind of Amazonian ascetic woman comes in, says, Ramakrishna says you should come to his room. And she says, oh, okay, let's go. Just like that, because she knew, just like she had been expecting it to come. And he, when he saw her, was very excited. And although he hadn't thought about it before, all of a sudden he was filled with pent-up anticipation. And the woman walks into his room and says, ah, my child, here you are. I knew you lived somewhere along the banks of the Ganges, and I've been looking for you. And now I've found you. We don't know very much about her background and all, but we know that she was, they're called Bhairavis, and it's nuns that practice Tantra and are wanderers. So all she had with her were some books. Some places I've read she had just had two books, and she had one change of clothes and something else. What did she have? Books, clothes. But anyway, you get the idea. Not much. She was traveling. She was on the road. She owned nothing. So the idea of that tantra, anyway, is that the object is to see the presence of God in everything, to see that everything is divine, everything is made up of God stuff. And tantra says there's two main obstacles to this. One is attraction, and the other is aversion. So you either see the thing and go, oh, I want that, or you see it and go, oh, yuck, and push it away from you. And either one is based on surface aspects of whatever it is. And so, as a result, you don't get to penetrate to what it really is. One of the authors gave a great example. This is like being a doctor who either is drawn to every patient's body, you know, sensually or sexually, or totally repulsed by the awful sores or the wound or whatever, and can't get the job done because of attraction or repulsion. And that the aspiring devotee is in the same boat. They have to be able to get rid of that. So there's a whole, I forget the number, I'm trying to think, it's either 36 or 39 tantric practices, not just one exercise, but 36, 39 series of exercises that she taught him, that he learned to do. And each one of them was to overcome a particular category of attraction and of aversion. And he did all of them, but there were some that he said later he just needed to get the suggestion of it, and he didn't actually have to do it, like sex and drinking intoxicants. But apparently he did eat meat, because that was a part of it, apparently, which was not something he would have normally done, but he went ahead and did that as a part of that tantric practice. But anyway, he went through all of those, and he later said that this is definitely a valid road to God realization, but it has undesirable features, and forbade his students to ever experiment or play with it. Oh, I know what she had. She had a little stone icon that was of, it represented all of the Vaishnavite, the Vishnu deities. And that's what she had with her other little thing, which of course he's an incarnation of Vishnu, right? So there was that representing all the Vaishnavite ones. So I won't go into, 64 major tantric sadhanas he went through and had to learn how to do them. Practice them till he had them down. But he went through, you know, started off with japa and pranayams and things like that, and went up into much more difficult forms. And also, she taught him, related to the tantric thing, she taught him kundalini yoga and like astral anatomy control. So there's, you know, part of my idea. Okay, he's beginning to put together the tools to be able to handle this incredible divine energy that he has access to, but it just plays havoc with his nervous system and with his mind. At the same time, and it may or may not have had to do with his work in Tantra, but at the same time, he began, and it left him later, but he had a period of a year or two where he could understand animals. He could understand what they were thinking. He knew what they were thinking, and he'd communicate with them back. He kind of looked at it as just a psychic power that he didn't really want to play with or need. But so he was in relationship with animals. He also gained access to the Om, which he didn't say anything about dropping off. But he was able to go deep, deep into the Om, and describes it as just thundering, incredible sound all around him. So he was able to do that at will. And this one's particularly fascinating. He developed, and it's not like he tried to do this, but he gained an ability to look really beautiful. And
when he was doing that, his skin would start to glow golden, and the light would begin to come out from his skin. And he tells about one situation. I forget the details of what he was doing, but he was either in a situation where he wanted to appear normal or he had to go. He was about to go to one. And he started to get in this bath. And all of a sudden his skin starts glowing and this light is there. He runs up on the roof and starts smacking himself. Says, go back, stop, go back in." And eventually, I don't know if it's because he did that or not, he was a pretty intense guy, as you can tell. The glowing, the golden glow went away, and he was able to go ahead and do whatever he was trying to do. So I'll say one little more, and then we'll take a break. In Hinduism, there are five bhavas of bhakti, like bhakti bhavas. And we don't hear about them much on this path. Although I think Swami actually mentions them in Raja Yoga, maybe, in just in the text. But it has to do with the way that the devotee sees himself in relationship with God. And so one is as a worshiper, just as we usually think of it, and most religions think of it. One is as a worshiper. The second is as a child or a servant. So you have God is the parent. Or God is the master, like with Hanuman, you know, God would be the master for Hanuman. The third is as a parent. That's one that's not so familiar to us. We're the parent. God is the child. God is the baby. We'll talk more about a couple of these. The fourth is the friend. And then the last one's the beloved. The beloved. The lover. But do you see a pattern there that's familiar to our path? What do we pray at the beginning of every prayer? Father, mother, we're the child, right? Friend, that's the friend, and the beloved. So we hit three of those five, and of course, worshiper, beloved what? God. And so we really hit four of those bhavas just when we pray. And that was a prayer that Master designed for us. That can't be coincident that he's trying to put us into that, to the mode of those bhavas when we pray. Okie doke. We'll take a quick break. Come back. And we'll hit just, probably only have time for two or maybe three of the ways he plunged into other religions and practices. So these people would show up and he would meet them and they would start telling him what they did and boom, off they would go. He would just plunge in and begin to do what it was. There may have been people who came with other things that he didn't. I don't know. But there are probably, I prepared six or seven, and there are a handful of others that he did of these different practices of different religions or different sects. Within Hinduism. So this one is called Bhadura Bhava, which is the beloved, you know, beloved God. He went very deep into this practice, and this is one actually that he did mostly on his own. But he started because Krishna, in that time frame, and for him, Krishna was the object of affection. So, yeah, he just said, okay, great, so that means I need to be a woman to relate to Krishna properly as my beloved. And so he started portraying himself as a woman, both in his outward attire and his attitudes and his emotions and his thinking. Because the idea is that if the devotee can make himself seriously believe that he belongs to the opposite sex, then he's moving towards being able to overcome the delusion of sex identification, sex differentiation, and know that that distinction is not absolute at all. So during the practice of this bhava, he asked Mathur, the money guy for him, if he would go get him women's attire, because most of the time he was only in a loincloth or, you know, maybe a robe like that picture.
there. And so he wanted to dress himself as one of the gopis. So M, being who he was, being his devotee and having plenty of funds and loving him, went out and bought very expensive Varanasi silk saris and gold jewelry for him and long, expensive, lavish wigs. And so for 6 months, Ramakrishna lived as a woman. And as soon as he would, as soon as he dressed, as soon as he put on the woman's clothing, his mind would, because he broke it up some that 6 months, but almost for that whole time he was. But when he would come back to it, his mind would just start to shift deeper and deeper into the mood of womanhood. And those who saw him just could not believe how feminine that he was. They were amazed at the transformation, but it was his voice, his language, his facial expressions, the way he walked, even slight gestures, all became feminine. And his benefactress, of course, still had the family home. You know, they lived in extended families, and he would go there and live with and hang out with the women in her estate. And this part, and they say that the women would soon forget that he was a man. Just because he so thoroughly portrayed that. So what he did was, for the family, he took over the preparation of the young women for when their husbands would come to visit them. So he would take the girl, because in that time, the men and the women, when they were younger, were separated, sometimes even if they were married, but especially in that early period when, you know, like with his wife, she was only 5 years old and went back to stay. So people who were in that period are the ones when they were coming and living with the in-laws' family, but not yet had the marriage become fully operational. So there are all these women, and the husbands would come and visit them all the time, right? So he took on the role of the person who prepared the girls, the young women, for that. He would adorn them. He would adorn the girl with ornaments and dress her hair, fix her hair up himself. And just as an older, more experienced woman, he would show her how to comport herself with her husband, how to speak in a suitably wifely fashion, and taking her by the hand when he'd gone through all this would take him out to what would amount to the parlor, I guess, in the end of home, and leave, you know, seat her with her husband and leave her there and then go back. So he just totally took it on. Fridai and Mathur, when they would see him across the room, couldn't distinguish him, couldn't tell which one he was from a whole group of ladies when he was across a, you know, room like this when he was over there. I want to read this one part because it is so great. Ramakrishna was wearing women's dress during the festival of Durga that year, 1864, and was taking part in the worship with the women of Mathur's family. After the first day's worship was over, he passed into a mood of spiritual absorption, losing all consciousness of his surroundings. But the time was coming up for the aratika, meaning it's a ceremony where it's like an enormous arati. The evening service, which is accompanied by the waving of lights, ringing of bells, sounding of gongs, and chanting, was about to begin. Mathur's wife, Jagadamba Dasi, found herself in a dilemma. She was eager to go to the hall where the astrika was, where the aratrika was being held. But she did not dare leave Ramakrishna alone, because quite recently, when he was in a similar state and he had been left alone, he had tumbled into a pan of live coals and burned himself quite badly. So she dare not leave him. But acting on a sudden inspiration, she started to deck out Ramakrishna with her most valuable ornaments and saying to him, meanwhile, it's time to wave the lights. Don't you want to come and fan Mother Durga? Come, let's wave the lights in front of Durga. It had often been noticed that Ramakrishna could be recalled from his deep meditation or ecstatic state to outer consciousness if some name or mantra related to the subject of his meditation was repeated in his ear several times. Jagadamba Dasi was aware of this. After a moment, Ramakrishna responded to the name of Mother Durga, roused himself, and went with Jagadamba Dasi into the hall. The ceremony began at once, and Ramakrishna started to fan the image of Durga with a kind of ritual fan, a chamara, which is made from the tail of a yak. Presently, Mathur himself entered the hall. According to the custom, the male devotee stood on one side, the female on the other. And Mathur immediately noticed a strange lady standing beside his wife. Now remember, this is a guy who spends hours with him, many, many days, and it was one of his two closest associates. He admired the nobility of her bearing and the richness of her dress and her ornaments, and supposed she must be some wealthy matron who had been invited by his wife to take part in the ceremony. When the ceremony was over, Mathur went in to see his wife and asked who the strange, impressive lady was. Jagadamba Dasi smiled and said, "You didn't know? That was father." Mathur said when he got over his surprise, "No one can know father if he doesn't allow himself to be known." So that was his preparations to get himself into a mindset where he could feel more deeply love for Krishna. He started doing this and had himself become like a woman, but it wasn't just immediately that Krishna responded to him. He did all this for Krishna. But Krishna did not come. And so soon, he forgot all about eating, he even forgot about drinking. He wept day and night over his separation from Krishna. And the yearning turned into a mad frenzy, for the divine Krishna started to play tricks on him, just like he had played with the gopis. If you've read those tales, he would tease him and taunt him. He would start to reveal himself a little, and then he would go away, but always keeping at a distance from Ramakrishna. So Ramakrishna's anguish brought on a return of some of his old symptoms, the locking of the joints, and we didn't talk about burning sensations and all, but he had those. So now, poor tortured Ramakrishna turned his prayer toward Radha and prayed to her to help him be able to connect with Krishna. And soon he enjoyed a vision of her and eventually saw and felt the figure of Radha merge right into his own body. And, of course, the love of Radha is the precursor of a vision of Sri Krishna, and soon Ramakrishna had that vision. An enchanting form of Krishna appeared to him, and then Krishna himself merged into Ramakrishna, and Ramakrishna became Krishna, completely forgot his own individuality. Of course, at that point, didn't care if he was male or female, completely disconnected from the world, and he saw Krishna in himself and only Krishna as the universe. So in this, he was really focused on the personal, you know, very personal experience of God as an individual. And sounds like a hard road to hoe. But fascinating about what he did with the getting himself positioned, getting himself poised. I can't help but thinking as I read these things, sort of how easy Master has made it for us. Of course, most of us are not at the level of Krishna, and maybe it makes no sense anyway, because Krishna was an avatar. He was completely liberated. Did I say Krishna? Of course, he was an avatar. Ramakrishna was an avatar. So, a second one is he had a teacher come who was an expert in Advaita Vedanta, yoga, the thing that's closest to our path. And his name was Totapudi. I actually have a picture of him. He's a Nagaswami, which you can probably tell without clothes, Swami. Totapudi was huge. And as you can see, he had dreadlocks that came close to the ground. And at this time, when he came to see Ramakrishna, he was about 100 years old. And he lived
into the 1960s. So he was going to be, some people say 250, but the general accepted thing is he was about 200 years old when he passed away. In fact, the main dates for him are 1761 to 1961. So don't know if there's anything numerically about that. But anyway, for years he had headed a monastery in the Punjab, way over on the other side of India, away from Calcutta. And he had trained all his life, in his youth and all, to be a Vedantic master. But he, you know, that whole system just looks on the world as a complete illusion. You know, just, you know, not at all considering anything here real enough to do anything except ignore it. But in this, he had a lot of responsibility. He had six or seven hundred renunciants in his monastery, so it was a big deal. But at a certain point, he just left it all and went off to practice his austerities by himself. And he practiced for 40 years on one of the seven, the banks of one of the seven sacred rivers in India, Narmada. And in fact, there's an interesting thing about that. The tradition has it that when the Ganges gets really, really filthy from pollution or whatever, it takes the form of a black cow and goes over to the Narmada and rinses to get clean. Because the Narmada, therefore, is supposed to be even have more cleansing power than the Ganges. At any rate, so he spent 40 years there and developed a level of realization, so he felt, okay, I'm ready to go. And then he started wandering, and he wandered all over India. Well, as a part of his journey, he was trekking along the Ganges, and he stumbled upon Dakshineswar. And again, this is just a relatively new temple. Not new little temple, but new big temple. And so people didn't necessarily know about it all around India yet. So he came across it, and naked, smeared with ashes all over his body, Totaputi strolled in through the temple garden and onto the grounds and noticed Ramakrishna sitting there. And Ramakrishna's clapping his hands ecstatically, chanting the name of Mother Kali. Well, Totaputi immediately recognized that here was someone who was sufficiently developed, even though he just looked like a simple devotee of the goddess, a misguided devotee of the goddess, because that's not absolute, right? That's a ephemeral and external thing. But despite that appearance, he realized he was inwardly prepared to receive initiation into the knowledge of the absolute, which Totaputi could give him. And when all this other stuff is left behind. Well, Totaputi approached Ramakrishna with the proposal that he receive initiation into Advaita Vedanta, and Ramakrishna said, well, I have to ask my mother first, and goes off to the temple and asks Kali if it's okay, and she says yes. So he comes back, and Totaputi explained that only a sannyas could receive this initiation. So the first thing he had to do was to renounce the world, basically renounce his marriage, you know, anything else, because he was not a monastic up to this point. He was a priest and so on, but he was not a monastic. So anyway, they set the day with which to do that. He only asked that it be kept a secret, so his mother, who would be horrified at the idea of him after losing the elder brother and all, saying, okay, now I'm going to be a monastic, a renunciate, that would break her heart. So it just had to be kept a secret. So on the appointed day, they came together, and they began going through all the rituals of renunciation. They burned his sacred Brahmin thread, because he couldn't be a Brahmin anymore, right? Had to renounce that. The tufted hair came off, completely severing himself from caste, religion, relationships, you know, relatives. And went through several other initiation procedures. And then they went into the meditation room to review some of the teachings of Vedanta and for Totapudi to instruct him in formless meditation, breaking through so he could experience God just as the ultimate consciousness without any form. And the task was not easy for Ramakrishna because he loved Divine Mother so much. And he would get to a certain point, get up to a certain point, and although his mind knew, because he accepted the teachings, that Divine Mother was just a figment of the imagination, albeit God's imagination, but still not real, he just couldn't go beyond it. And Ramakrishna later said that the radiant, too familiar figure of the blissful Divine Mother would step in front of him when he was just about to go into, you know, through the doorway into the light of the Absolute. And he had to back out. And Swami said, every time you reach the doorway of the ultimate samadhi, absorption of the self in the infinite, he would see Divine Mother and he would just be overcome with this love for her. And he didn't want to go where she wasn't. And he would just stay there. Well, Totapudi didn't have a lot of sympathy for that particular sentiment. And he looked around and, first of all, he got very excited and said, "What? You can't do it? You say you can't do it, but you have to." And it's basically, "It's my job to make sure you do." And so he looked around the meditation room and he saw a shard of glass over in the corner. And so he went and got the pointed shard of glass and took it and just twisted it right down into the spiritual eye of Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna went through with that intense physical experience. It released him somehow. What he said about it later was, let's see if I can find it. Anyway, basically he said that when that came, he was finally able to pick up the sword of discrimination. And he had to. His experience was that here was this live being that he loved so much, Divine Mother, and he had to take the sword and just split her right down the middle and kill her. Which helps you understand why he had the problem doing it. That was his experience of it. But then he shot out into formlessness. And he stayed in samadhi for 3 days. And in the meantime, Totapudi had a little fit with some of the other people around saying, "You mean to tell me that it took me 40 years of tapasya on the banks of that river, and Ramakrishna could do it in one day?" But of course, he had great, great respect. But he felt it was a miracle. He felt it was a miracle of the sort that he had never experienced before. And from that time on, Ramakrishna considered Totapudi as his guru, and that's how we all referred to him. He was a very orthodox monk. I mean, that doesn't look orthodox to us, but it was, you know, in that time. And he adhered to all of the rules very strictly. And one of the rules was that as a renunciant monk, he could not stay in any one place for more than 3 days. He had to move on. However, he did whatever he had to do to get himself excused from that. And he stayed with Ramakrishna for 11 months. And they instructed each other, Totapudi said. There was a lot more that he could teach Ramakrishna about the Vedantic way and yoga. And he said that there was a great deal that Ramakrishna was able to teach him. There's a fun little story while he was there for those 11 months, because it took more than just Ramakrishna teaching him, I guess. But he was laid up all of a sudden with a severe attack of dysentery. And because of it, it was very intense, and he found he couldn't even meditate. And he said, "Okay, that's it. you know, the body giving me a problem, I can handle that. And kind of went down a list. But if I'm unable to meditate, what is even the point of being alive? So he decided to go drown himself in the Ganges. And so he walked down to the Ganges, which is, he must have gone out and around streets, because as you can see in some of the photographs, it's actually right on the Ganges. But he went down where he could find a deep area of the Ganges, and he just walked into the river. He was focused. He was going to do it. He didn't want to let anything do it. So he just walked straight ahead and walked and walked and walked. And then all of a sudden, he found himself on the opposite bank. And he turned around and looked, and the Ganges was still deep. It was all there. But he turned around then. He turned around and looked, and he was so overcome by the beauty of what he saw, the clouds and the skies and the trees and all. And it brought him into the realization that what Divine Mother had provided for us here on Earth, in that particular case through nature, was not something only to be shunned and pushed away from, rejected, but it was something to be embraced and loved, second to the absolute perhaps, but still had a great deal of value for him spiritually. And then he walked back across the Ganges and saw that the water just kept going down and down, and everyone up above his knees as he walked into it. So sort of like Moses and the river. That was the time, it was at that point that he felt he had become fully realized. He already thought he was, but there was another level for him to go to. So he actually reached full awakening after Ramakrishna did, that he had helped. And then after that happened, he decided that his goals had been accomplished, and got back on his horse, so to speak, and rode off into the sunset, rode for another 100 years, so that people in the middle of the last century knew about him. So just to tell you, there he also studied to see, those both actually were Hindu, but he also took on Islam. And when he was doing all the Islamic practices, he also dressed as a Muslim. And he says specifically as an Arab Muslim. He put on their clothing, and he really got very hungry for the type of food that they ate. So he insisted that they go get a Muslim cook and prepare his food. But they ate really differently than the Hindus. So, of course, that was a big scandal, and they reached a compromise so that they got a Hindu cook who knew how to cook with Muslim technique, and they didn't include any beef. And so they satisfied what he needed. He later said, "I devoutly repeated the name of Allah, wore clothes like the Arab Muslims, and said their prayers 5 times daily. And I felt disinclined to even look at Hindu images, much less worship them. For the Hindu way of thinking had disappeared altogether from my mind." And he never went into the temple during this time period. And he moved out of his room. I assume something was going on, knowing he'd need to move back in there. Didn't maybe want to stay in there where a Muslim had been living. I don't know. But he found another place in the temple grounds where he could go and stay. And he said then that he had gained the full realization of that faith. And he also did it with Christianity. And with Christianity, the same thing happened to him. Maybe it didn't happen in the others because they were connected to, you know, if you think of Hinduism as a huge, broad umbrella, they were under that umbrella. And so his mind maybe didn't have to reject even things that were not really accepted there. But for his experience with Christianity, a man came who kind of took the place of Rani and Mathur to some degree, and helped him pay for things and took care of the worldly business for him. But he had experience with Christianity. And so he read to Ramakrishna from the Bible. He explained all about Jesus and his life, Sri Isha, is referred to, and there was a picture of the Madonna with baby Jesus on his lap. And at one point, as they were reading and discussing, he was learning about Christianity, the pictures started to glow. And from both Mary and the baby, rays of light shot out and entered his heart. And I don't know if it was right then or if it had already happened, but he couldn't really think about the deities then, that you know, he had loved so much just days before, and he would completely forget to go to the temple, but developed a great love for Jesus at that time and just felt filled with it. And he said, he asked Polly, Mom, what are you doing to me? Both these times when his mind just started to change. All of a sudden, everything he knew and had lived for since he was a little child, he was feeling like pushing it away. But he went into a three-day absorption, probably right after those rays hit his heart, although I'm not completely sure. He went into a three-day absorption, and he was in a little grove they have there that a lot of temple areas have, where five special trees are planted, kinds of trees. But he was in that, and a foreign-looking person walked into the grove of trees. It had a beautiful face, and very large eyes, and just a radiance of uncommon brilliance. And then the voice spoke, saying, "This is Jesus Christ, the great yogi, the loving Son of God, who was one with his Father, and who shed his heart's blood and suffered tortures for the salvation of mankind." And then the figure came over and embraced Ramakrishna and disappeared into Ramakrishna's body. And from that point onward, Ramakrishna was convinced that Jesus was truly a divine incarnation, and that Christianity provided one of the methods of God realization. When he passed away in his own room, there was a picture of Christ on his altar that his disciples said he did daily puja in front of. And he also had one hanging on the wall of Jesus saving St. Peter from drowning in the water. So after doing all of these things later on in life, Ramakrishna said that what he had learned from all this was, as many faiths, so many paths to God.
So what was Ramakrishna's, why did he come, and what was his message to us? Did he have any?
Ramakrishna?
Yeah.
Well, one, and the one that I focused on for this class, is the same of Masters. We're talking about the Church of All Religions. You know, that union with God has very little to do with religion and everything to do with one's consciousness, and using devotion in particular to be able to reach that point where it converges. I mean, that was actually his problem when he had to kill Divine Mother, as his devotion was so great it had become an obstacle. Blasphemy, just to say it. but you know, even there, it wouldn't be just devotion, there would be attachment.
Just like he was attached to the physical form or the image of the mother instead of the real infinite image.
Yeah.
That's why he had to kill the form.
Right. To free himself from it.
The pure essence of all of the religions seem to be the same. You wind up in the same place.
Here's a couple more shots of the temple. It's a big place. And if you go there these days, it's going to be more like this.
Wow.
You want to plan the day. You don't want to go barefoot in any place. You don't have to go barefoot. Or you want something between your feet and the pavement if it's the summertime. But wonderful.
the building just over here is where you can go in and meditate after you've seen
them. That's where you were talking about going, right? Yeah.
Yeah. The
I don't know. The meditation hall, something.
There's a master meditating there. And I think that people, somebody in India is saying the pilgrims from India, that they go, they exactly know the pillar where the master is meditating. I was trying to get to the picture, but I didn't quite know.
Oh boy, that'd be fun to see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's not when that actually happened.
Well, when we were there on pilgrimage last time, they told us that. Not where, but just that. That he had meditated in. But just that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, finding out exactly where he was in there would be wonderful. Go sit on that spot. Yeah. Okie doke.
Right.
That's it for this time. If we do this again next year, we'll talk about after this period is over, and the way he found his true disciples. He was very much like Master. The people who stuck with him and really are building his work came later, you know, the really devoted disciples. Because he's still got another 20 years. We haven't touched
that.
What's the name of it? Just Ramakrishna.
Very hard to find.
Is it?
I can send you the link if you want to. But it's so amazing. There's just every single action that you make. And all of the shows that I've done, they look exactly like the people.
Wow.
Every single that I've done comes from the ground.
The Great Master, that one, Ramakrishna, the Great Master, that biography?
No, I didn't have asked one, because all the words, so that has a conversation. So everything he says in the movie is actually an actual thing
that he said, that he spoke. And where is it? Is it on, what platform is it on? On YouTube, that's right.
I can send it to you.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. And I had a request to say what books might be interesting to use. And of course, there's The Gospel of Ramakrishna, and that's by Sri M. And there's Ramakrishna, the Great Master, by Saradananda. And then also, I was mentioning, especially too easy to use, to read, is Ramakrishna and His Disciples by Christopher Isherwood. But then also there are three books by Swami Chetananda, They Lived with God, and Ramakrishna as We Saw Him, and God Lived with Them, that talk about the perceptions and the reminiscences of individual direct disciples, chapter by chapter.